This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Melissa Block with the itch to make something from scratch. And why not something seasonal? Something would never have occurred to me to make at home if I hadn't been persuaded by a new book from Jennifer Reese, who describes homemade marshmallows as fairy food, pillowy, quivering, and soft.
Oh, they just taste so much better. They're fluffier, and they're just more delicious. They don't turn out to be cheaper, but they are better.
So, homemade marshmallows it will be.
It's a marshmallow world in the winter when the snow comes to cover the ground.
Jennifer Reese joined me from San Francisco to guide me through the marshmallow making process, which turned out to be surprisingly simple. You'll find the full recipe at npr.org. It involves gelatin dissolved in water and a fast boil of sugar, water, and corn syrup.
Yeah, this is the sugar syrup that makes everything happen. Now you turn on the stove to high and let it rip. And you want to let it boil till it gets to about 265 degrees Fahrenheit.
Meanwhile, we separate a couple of eggs and the whites go into the mixer. They need to be beaten until they're firm and glossy, so time to put the hammer down on the KitchenAid.
It's like a race here, Jennifer. Will the egg whites be beaten before the sugar syrup reaches 265 degrees?
Okay, the sugar syrup is at a furious boil, and the egg whites are coming along nicely.
Ooh, it's getting so fluffy.
Once the sugar syrup is hot enough, it gets whipped into the egg whites, along with the gelatin and some vanilla.
Okay, now, Jennifer, it's looking really floppy. Is that good?
Yeah, it's fine. You just have to let it go and let it keep beating, and it'll eventually come together and become a beautiful cloud. Puffy, white, billowing cloud.
Which, after many minutes, it does. And then we pour the whole beautiful, sticky, shiny goo onto a prepared cookie sheet.
Ooh.
That's going to sit overnight. So let's go back to Jennifer Reese and the book that inspired us to set out on our marshmallow adventure. It's called Make the Bread by the Butter. And it chronicles her odyssey through trial and error of figuring out what foods are worth the effort of making yourself and what you should just buy right off the shelf.
I've always been a really avid and ambitious cook. And a few years ago, I lost my job and I had this moment of thinking, well, you know, I'm going to save all this money by doing all those exciting Little House on the Prairie cooking jobs that I've always wanted to try.
Jennifer Reese's enthusiasm knew no bounds. So she wasn't just baking bread or grinding peanut butter. She was frying up potato chips, making her own Pop-Tarts, stretching curds into mozzarella, infusing vermouth, curing pastrami, and fermenting kimchi, not to mention raising chickens, turkeys, and goats at her home in the San Francisco Bay Area. Jennifer Reese includes a hassle factor with each recipe in her book, ranging from none at all to truly a pain in the to you will want to bludgeon yourself with your rolling pin about halfway through this project.
Anything was fair game. Worcestershire sauce. Oh yeah, I'm going to look up a recipe. And I tried it and it was absolutely stupendous. Pastrami was a lot of work.
Was it worth it, the pastrami?
Yeah, it was worth it in the moment. But I haven't done it since.
Tell me about the Worcestershire sauce. You rave about this in the book.
Yeah, I've only actually made it once because I use very little Worcestershire sauce. I mean, how many bottles do you go through in a lifetime?
Yeah, one, I think.
Yeah, it was just black and tarry, and it just had so much flavor. And, you know, tasted against the kind, you know, in the paper-wrapped bottle, it was just outstanding. It wasn't quite as vinegary and thin. I think it's really worth doing because you only have to do it so rarely.
You know, I have to ask, Jennifer, how big a pantry and a freezer you must have, because at certain points it seems like you must have camembert ripening in the closet and sauerkraut fermenting or doing whatever sauerkraut does, and you have vermouth infusing and pancetta that is aging hanging from your pipes. It sounds like your house basically got turned into an experimental larder for a long time.
It was crazy. It was crazy. There were like jars of yogurt and creme fraiche on the counter. And I had this immense prosciutto that I'd made sitting in the refrigerator. Yeah, and the cheese situation got crazy. I was making cheese every day for a while because it was so exciting to do.
Well, since your premise here is make it or buy it, let's tick through a few of these. And you tell me whether we should be making it or buying it, okay?
Okay.
Hot dog buns.
hot dog buns I think you should make, because they are so much more delicious than what you can buy. They also cost less, and they're quite easy.
Really? Okay. Bacon. You make your own bacon. Make it or buy it.
You know, I have made my own bacon, and it's delicious. But you can buy bacon, and unless you have a smoker, and if you're going to try to smoke it in your own house, as I have done, I think it's probably easier to buy it. It's definitely easier to buy it. I think it's probably worth buying.
Well, we did hot dog buns. What about ketchup? Ketchup, make it or buy it?
Ketchup, I made a number of different ketchups, and I was pretty sure that homemade ketchup would have to be more delicious than Heinz. But then I had a ketchup tasting party, and everybody preferred the Heinz, because if it doesn't taste like Heinz, it's not really ketchup.
Right.
That's not necessarily a good thing. It's just the way it is. You know, if it's a little different, it's not ketchup.
Which brings us back to our marshmallows. Now, I've cut them into cubes, they're dusted with powdered sugar, and they look fantastic, but they're not the classic jet-puffed marshmallow everyone remembers from their childhood. So, would mine stand up to store-bought? I brought them to the harshest and hungriest food critics known to humankind. The staff of All Things Considered, starting with a man of very discriminating taste, my co-host, Robert Siegel.
It's amazing.
It tastes like a marshmallow.
It tastes exactly like a marshmallow, and except there's no fire around it. No, it's great. It's terrific.
It's quite marshmallowy.
You made these?
This is delicious. This is really, really good.
Lynn Neary has arrived.
That's really good. I think it's better than store-bought. I like the texture better. It's a little creamier.
Those are amazing. I can't wait to make them. Yeah.
Have another.
All right. Hold on. So marshmallow clouds be friendly.
And if you want to try making the marshmallows yourself, you can find the recipe and a step-by-step photo guide at our website, npr.org. We also have the recipes for hot dog buns and Worcestershire sauce from Jennifer Reese's book, Make the Bread, Buy the Butter. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Lynn Neary. Some people are rethinking the tradition of gift-giving. For example, the website whatididn'tbuy.org. It gives family and friends the option to donate to a charity based on the dollar value of the tie or earrings they chose not to buy you. The idea is to make charitable gift-giving a little less abstract. Well, NPR's Allison Aubrey reports on another organization that's doing just that with animals.
To find out just what $40 will get you in the toy aisle this season, I've come to Target to check things out. Here's one. It's in a remote control robotic puppy that wags its tail and makes funny puppy sounds. Jim Eckhart says there was a time he'd fill his shopping cart with these kinds of toys for his 6 grandchildren, but a few years back he had an epiphany. The kids all had too much stuff, and their parents agreed. A lot of toys just end up as junk.
That's right, and then probably in a couple of years put it in a garage sale. You look at all of the things that we throw away, and that money could be put to better use.
But how? After checking out alternatives, Eckhart settled on the idea of livestock, farm animals. He'd give one animal on behalf of each grandkid.
We bought one of them, a little flock of chickens. Another one, I think it was a pig. I think actually we bought Lydia a goat.
Now, Lydia, who was about 7 at the time and lives in the Bay Area in California, remembers it well. When she heard about the gift, she thought she was getting a new pet.
Yeah, he gave me a goat, and I remember I didn't really understand. I thought I was actually getting a goat.
But then her mom, Jeline Laporte, explained to her that the gift was really something else entirely. It was a contribution given in her name. She was never going to see this animal. But through the organization Heifer International, a goat would be given from her to a poor family in Vietnam or Africa. The family could drink the goat's milk, breed the animal, and eventually perhaps sell the goat meat.
It wasn't the way they were thinking of it as, oh, a fun pet. It was actually an animal that was going to help these people earn money for food and clothing, and just really the bare essentials of life.
The idea that giving someone a few goats or a flock of chicks can change their life by giving them a way to earn a living is not new. But how does it actually work? Well, Heifer's been around since the 1940s. It has about $100 million in annual revenues and 400,000 donors. Heifer gets high marks for keeping administrative costs low and using the contributions to both buy the animals and provide training and support to the recipients. In a nutshell, it's the teach a man to fish model.
what we're trying to do is establish a base from which individuals who are really, really poor, who are truly the poorest of the poor, generate a source of income for many years to come.
Dean Carlin is a professor of economics at Yale who studies innovative solutions to poverty. He says groups such as Heifer are popular with donors because people love the idea of connecting one family with one animal. They can tell their friends.
I gave somebody a goat, and that's a very real thing, and we understand what that is. And it makes us, and it's very concrete, and it's yet small enough that we can actually give it, and that makes us feel good. It's much better than thinking I gave $50 towards a $3 million project, of which what did my money really do?
Carlin says the part that's more complicated for donors to understand is that on its own, the gift of one goat or a pig is not a magic bullet. It takes a lot more to lift someone out of poverty and keep them there. It's a complicated process.
It's easy to make things sound good, and there are lots of things that work, but it's not always the things that sound best.
Carlin has never evaluated Heifer, but in studying similar programs, he finds what works best is what he calls the big push. You give the recipients livestock, but you also train them to care for their animals. You help them set up savings accounts, get their children in school, even give them short-term food assistance so they don't end up eating that one goat they've been given. Steve Worlin, who works in Haiti for a charity called Fankozi, uses this big push approach. We reached him on his mobile phone outside Port-au-Prince, where he just wrapped up a coaching session with one woman named Olani, who was given some goats.
The ultra-poor are not used to planning of any sort. They're used to waking up every day and figuring out where they're going to get food that day to feed their kids.
But Olani is now able to plan a bit. Her goats have had kids, so she's got a bunch of them, and she's planning to trade 7 of them for a horse, which she'll use to haul more goat meat to market instead of having to carry it herself.
It dramatically expands her ability to have a business.
And this puts her one more step up the long staircase out of poverty.
The kids are getting 2 meals a day. They're in school. The asset base is starting to develop. All the problems aren't solved. They're still very poor, but they're not desperate.
It's just the beginning of building a better life. And for many donors, their gift of a goat or a chicken is just the beginning, too. Remember Lydia Laporte, who was confused by her grandfather's gift of a goat? Well, not anymore. She's now 14, and she's helped raise about $20,000 for Heifer from her friends and family.
If you just think about the big picture and everything that we have, we should be the happiest people because we're, like, a lot of the most fortunate.
Lydia says her own awareness of poverty has taught her that getting stuff doesn't make her nearly as happy as giving. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
From Coco Robichaud to Coquito, that's an eggnog that's as much a part of a Puerto Rican Christmas as sunlight and beaches. Today in New York, 12 Coquito makers will contend to be this year's Coquito Masters champion. Debbie Quiñones is the founder of the International Coquito Federation. She joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
And what is a coquito?
Coquito is made specifically with condensed milk, evaporated milk, coconut, rum, vanilla, nutmeg, and some other spices that tend to vary with various families.
So everybody has their own personal recipe.
Absolutely, and that's what is the joy and beauty of this contest that I organize. It's called Coquito Masters. It started when my mother's friend passed away, who was the coquito maker for our family, and I was left without any coquito, and realizing that the concept of culinary legacy was really important, and I started having this event in my house, basically with some friends and family.
What can we expect today?
You have the top 12 Coquito Masters from the 5 boroughs, from different neighborhoods, and even Connecticut. And, of course, the defending champion, who is Maritza Acosta. It's really an exciting opportunity and experience to see people coming in with this sense of pride and competition. I have to say that the competition is fierce.
Are people eager to share their recipes?
No. This is something that's really intense. We have the competition today, and as a result of the growth and expansion of this initiative, we have decided that in consultation with the Museo de Barrio, that in a new twist, what we have now is a coquito crawl, which is promoting the tourism of East Harlem, where restaurants have come on board, and they will serve the winning contestant's coquito, and we have a trolley that's going to go around the neighborhood. So ultimately, after you taste from 2 to 4, people can go back to the Museo del Barrio at 6:30, where we will announce the winner.
Does the winner have to share his or her recipe?
No, 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 no. That's like really something that we don't get into.
Okay.
The third place winner in 2008, she stole the recipe from her father, who had it under his bed in a locked box. She actually stole the
recipe.
And
you rewarded that kind of family pilferage?
The mother was in the, she was part of the collaboration, and she took the recipe and put it into the contest and won third place.
Well, happy holidays, and may all your coquitos be smooth.
Or, thank you.
Or whatever a gentleman says to a lady.
Thank you so much.
Debbie Quiñones speaking with us from New York. The Coquito Masters Championship happens today in Spanish Harlem. And to find a recipe for a coquito, you can go to our website, npr.org. This is NPR News.
We've been asking listeners to tell us about their favorite holiday foods. Wassail, or maybe you've heard it as wassail, is a traditional English drink celebrated in this old Yuletide carol. Wassail, wassail, wassail. Intrigued independent producer Kathleen Osborne embarked on a quest around New England for wassail.
My first stop in search of wassail was the Wassail Festival in Woodstock, Vermont. But I found more horses than raised glasses. In Woodstock, wassail is more of a Christmas celebration with a horse parade and a bit of caroling rather than a drink. Beth Finlayson of the Woodstock Chamber of Commerce says it's an old Yuletide tradition.
Wassail actually came from the Norse folks, and people would have a special drink during the winter solstice and say wassail to you, which is good health.
Few places in Woodstock were serving it, so Beth sent me to the source, the Prince and the Pauper restaurant. Vincent Talento is the owner, and he gave me a taste of their recipe.
To your health.
Wassail. Indeed.
Wassail. Wassail. Isn't that good?
It is.
It's a citrusy cider.
They make a special batch of the malt cider just for the festival, but more people were ordering martinis. So I called up my friend, Ben Jacks, who grew up with wassail as a Christmas Eve tradition. He gave me his family recipe, which didn't contain a drop of cider.
It's like a very, very strong punch. You know, so it's like champagne and vodka, a lot of really kind of intense berry flavors in it. And basically the idea is you have to drink everything in the punch. You know, that's, you know, with your whole family. So you put it right down. And while everyone else is singing, you need to be actually drinking out of the wassail bowl.
Around Boston, where Ben grew up, their wassail ritual was a bit of an oddity.
Yeah, I literally know not one other person in my life that does that.
So I have found the holy grail of wassailing.
Exactly.
Seemed like wassail could be just about anything, but a lot of recipes mention a hot, spiced beer. So I met up with Randy Barrell, manager of the Modern Homebrew Emporium in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who makes his wassail with a homebrew brown ale.
What I did is I put a measure of the beer into a crock pot, and to it I added a variety of spices that I had around the house. Clove and allspice and cinnamon. And then as we taste it, if I decide it's not sweet enough, there's a little brown sugar I can throw into the mix. Oh. Cheers. Wassail. I'd say very fortifying.
I'd say a bit medicinal for my taste. Randy says I'll have to find my own recipe.
You need to make it your own. You need to make it personal. And I think that's where a lot of the fun comes in.
Looking for a libation, what I really found was that holiday spirit. For NPR News, I'm Kathleen Osborne in Boston.